Happy summer from the Rocky Mountains. This is Go West Young Podcast, your show about the outdoors and America's public lands from the Center for Western Priorities. I'm Aaron Weiss, taping this outside on a beautiful summer evening up here in the mountains. It is gorgeous out here, finally. We have a fascinating interview coming for you that I did at the Outdoor Retailer Trade Show earlier this month. It's with journalist and river guide Heather Hansman. She combined her two skills into a new book that is called Downriver. It's equal parts adventure memoir and policy reporting based on a solo raft trip she did down the Green River, more than 700 miles long. Plus, we will look back at the end of the road for America's most famous highway, the last days of Route 66 this week in Western history. Also, a quick update on our summer road trip. Plans are coming together. We are going to be in Santa Fe in mid-July. We will bring you a quick update when the exact location and time are locked down. That'll be here in this feed, or just keep an eye on our Facebook page. But go ahead, pencil that in there. Mid-July, we will be in Santa Fe. Come say hi to us. All right, let's do the news, starting with a major victory for the Mojave Desert. A federal judge threw out a decision from the Trump administration that said the proposed Cadiz water pipeline would not need an environmental review. Cadiz had argued that it didn't need that review because it had the right to build along a railroad right-of-way. The Obama administration had taken the opposite view, but then Cadiz got what it wanted after David Bernhardt became deputy secretary at the Interior Department. Bernhardt, of course, had been a lobbyist for Cadiz. The judge last week blocked the pipeline on two separate grounds. First, the court threw out that railroad argument, since the pipeline wouldn't primarily help the railway in a significant way. Secondly, the judge said that the Interior Department did not provide legal justification for reversing its previous position. Now, Cadiz is claiming that this is all just a procedural snafu and confidently predicts that Interior will write exactly what it needs to put the pipeline back on track. A year ago, last June, we did an entire episode about what's at stake here with Cadiz. David Lamfrom from the National Parks Conservation Association explained the science that's involved here. The best science right now suggests that if the pipeline gets built and Cadiz starts draining the aquifer under the Mojave Desert, it could dry up springs that are the only source of water for wildlife for hundreds of miles in any direction. We've got a link to that episode in the show notes. It is very much worth revisiting. All right, one other story to watch involves the Freedom of Information Act, which we have been talking about here over the last several episodes. After the Interior Department got caught letting political appointees interfere with public document production, the Environmental Protection Agency looked around and said, well, hey, that sounds like a great idea. Why don't we get into that game too? EPA just this week published a new rule that lets political appointees have the last word on what's released under FOIA and even lets them tell people that no records were found after they're removed. And unlike the Interior Department, which at least opened up a short comment period before trying to change its FOIA rules, EPA just went right ahead and published that new rule without any public input at all. Now, needless to say, this is probably not legal on a couple fronts. First off, by not allowing any public comments, it likely violates the Administrative Procedures Act. And secondly, the rule almost certainly runs afoul of FOIA itself. The Society of Environmental Journalists just fired off a very strong letter opposing the change. The Sierra Club immediately threatened to sue. And even Republican Senator Chuck Grassley went on the floor of the Senate to say that he is working on a bill to prevent this sort of political interference and to also close a loophole that the Supreme Court opened up last week when it issued a ruling that lets private companies block all sorts of information when they come up in FOIA requests. As we have been saying, keep your eye on this space because these FOIA stories are not going away. We are here at Outdoor Retailer talking to Heather Hansman, the author of the recently released book, Downriver, Into the Future of Water in the West. Heather, welcome to Go West Young Podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with the basics. This is kind of half memoir, half policy study. What in the world inspired you to write this book?
That's a really good way of framing it up, I think. I had been a raft guide for a long time, and then I was a journalist, and I'm somebody who, you know, water and rivers are a big part of my life, as is writing, and in kind of digging into water and reading about water and trying to learn more about, you know, water in the Colorado River Basin and kind of in the western U.S. where I live, there weren't any books that were kind of telling me the stories that I wanted to hear. You know, everyone, when you talk about water books, everyone kind of always holds up Cadillac Desert as like the book about water. And it's amazing, but it's 30 years old at this point, and it's a brick. Like, it's not an easy thing to read through. So I wanted to, like you're saying, I wanted to kind of get into the policy and the history and the climate science behind who uses water in the West and how they do and don't get along and kind of where the pressures are going to be in the future. But I wanted to do it in a way that, you know, people could pick up and read through and enjoy, which is kind of where that memoir, so the backbone of the story is a trip that I took down the Green River. I paddled the whole thing. So by kind of using that memoir aspect and the trip, I wanted to make it more sort of like tangible and real when I got into the wonky policy stuff.
So before you decided to write this, you had worked both as a raft guide and as an environmental journalist. What kind of preparation from both those roles did you do before you embark on something as big as this? I mean, this is 700 plus miles by yourself in a raft.
Yeah, my mom was kind of like, oh, all those years of raft guiding are finally paying off. I'd kind of dreamed up this idea for the trip as a way to kind of, you know, I'd been thinking a lot journalistically and writing about, you know, ag versus cities or how people kind of battle about water. And I wanted to do it in this way that was like on the ground and tangible. So a lot of the kind of background reporting was going in, lining out people to talk to and kind of figuring out who were the people managing the dams, who were the fish biologists, who were the ranchers I could talk to about what they were doing water-wise. And so there was some, you know, on the ground background reporting, and then making sure I understood the Colorado River Compact and the policy, and that stuff took a really long time to kind of really feel like I had my hands around reporting-wise. And then as far as the trip and the guide preparation goes, that was sort of a whole different boondoggle. That was actually sort of the hardest, scariest part of, you know, it was actually, for me, once I was on the river, things sort of clicked into place. And I, you know, like the muscle memory came back and the kind of like knowing how to run rivers came back. But the initial planning of where are you going to stop? How do you shuttle? Where can you camp? That felt like the really intimidating part in planning it and lining it out. So yeah, it was a lot of different, a lot of wiggling in lots of different parts of my life.
So you get through this, you paddle 700 miles, you talk to lots of people. How did, when you get to the end of it, how did it change your perspective on the demands that we collectively in the West place on the Green River and, by extension, the Colorado River?
Yeah, I think for me, and this is kind of the thing that I hope comes through the most in the book, the sort of biggest high-level, high-value thing that I took away from it was that I knew things were complicated, but things are even much more complicated than I thought, because I had kind of come in being like, well, conservation means saving water and having water to paddle on, and really that view was pretty narrow-minded, and by talking to ranchers whose view of conservation is using the water as many times as possible as it goes through their property, my kind of, you know, framework for what using water well was sort of narrow given like the whole spectrum. So now I think hopefully the takeaway is that everyone for the most part is trying to do good and trying to like make smart choices, but those things look different depending on what angle you're coming from. So the challenge is really like getting people to talk about those things and kind of deciding collectively how to layer all those uses on top of each other.
So then in terms of your research and everyone getting along, you went to a lot of public meetings in your preparation for this book. I imagine they got pretty heated. Did you learn anything about how we can avoid that pitfall of everyone blaming each other and move to finding cooperation, collaboration on water challenges?
Yeah, it's funny that you mentioned the public meetings, because kind of the one of the sort of like flashpoints for me was this public meeting I went to in Vernal, Utah. They'd been releasing a lot of water out of Flaming Gorge Dam. The ag producers and commercial fishermen downstream were really angry about when the flows were coming, and I came into this public meeting and I thought somebody was going to get punched.
Wow.
Or like some, you know, it was heated in the room. And eventually by the end of the night, after, you know, NOAA had explained their forecasting and the Bureau of Reclamation had explained why they're releasing water and the fishermen could kind of explain why they were losing money because of the flows, everyone there was a point of like, okay, I understand that you're not trying to screw me over. You're just trying to make things work for yourself. And I think having people that like actually getting people into a space where they can sort of like see the other side, I think is really, from what I've seen, sort of like the most valuable constructive way to figure that stuff out. But it also is really hard to physically get people in the same space, especially on a kind of a broad scale.
The Green River is the largest tributary of the Colorado. Early this year, all seven Colorado River Basin states signed a historic drought contingency plan. From your perspective, having done this reporting, how big a step in the right direction is it? Is this like a major, huge deal, or is it a reasonable step and there's going to be a whole lot more required down the road?
Yeah, I think it's kind of both. I think it's a really, really, really huge deal in that this is the first time that the states have voluntarily agreed on any kind of cutback. That's never happened before. That's a big, even getting, like I was saying earlier, even getting those people in the same room to see the other side of it is basically unprecedented. But from my understanding and from talking to people who know way more about it than I do, I think the actual, you know, like measurement change of what those takeaways are is kind of like a minor step. Like it doesn't, the actual, you know, things that they agreed to give up on aren't going to make a huge difference, but I think it's more the principle of having an agreement that's a big deal.
It seems like the basis of this agreement is acknowledging there's not enough water to go around in these western states. How much of a shortage is there looking ahead in the next 20, 30, 50 years?
Yeah, I'm not a climate scientist, but from what I've talked to people about and learned, it's significant. Brad Udall, who's at CSU, and Jonathan Overpeck have a paper that came out a couple of years ago that's been something that is really formative for me in thinking about that. And there they modeled out precipitation change and temperature change, because, you know, when everything's hotter, everything needs more water. And they found, I don't want to get the numbers wrong, but I think they found that flows in the basin have already reduced by 19%
wow.
since the turn of the century, which is, I mean, the southwestern U.S. has been in drought for, yeah. you know, this is a wet year, but we've been in drought for the past 20 years. And they're predicting that those flows will be reduced by up to 50% by the end of the century. And so we have this framework where we already, you know, there's already more water allocated than actually exists in the river. And then on top of that, climate change is going to make everything harder and tighter.
And so then that brings us to this concept of unallocated acre feet of water in the Green River and in the Colorado. Explain what that means to have unallocated water and who benefits, what benefits from that.
Yeah, that's that gets weedy pretty quick.
But we're a weedy podcast.
Yeah, so I mean basically, and I don't want to bore people with this, but the framework for how water is used in the Colorado River is the Colorado River Basin Compact, which was signed in the 1920s. And that broke up how much water they thought was running through the Colorado River Basin each year, and then they broke it up by an upper and lower basin, and then within that, each state got a percentage, basically. And so each state is basically allowed to allocate their amount of water. And the tricky part is that they allocated, within the compact, they allocated more water than actually exists in the river. They thought there's 16.5 million acre-feet allocated. They thought that averages were about 18 million acre feet coming through the river each year, and it turns out that it's closer to 15 historically. And so a state like, for instance, Wyoming, where the Green runs through, hasn't allocated all of their share of water. But there's also this sort of problem where if all the water was to be allocated, there wouldn't be enough to go around. So that unallocated water is sort of the wiggle room potentially in the future, but it's also things that each state legally feels like they have rights to. So it's a tricky math problem.
Is it a use it or lose it situation? If Wyoming doesn't use it, then Colorado or Arizona or California wants it?
Yeah. Or even, you know, say, for instance, Colorado, you know, we're in Denver right now. Denver is a big growing city. Say Denver is already piping some of that Green River, Colorado River water into town. You can't, and all of a sudden Wyoming wants theirs, but it doesn't exist in the river because Colorado's already claimed their share. Basically, you could be at, even though you might historically have senior water rights, if water doesn't physically exist, the paperwork breaks down.
Compare for us then what you learned in Wyoming, a major agriculture mining state where those are the major demands, versus here in Colorado where you've got a growing population wanting water just in urban areas. How are those meetings, how are the conversations about water different from state to state?
Yeah, it's a tricky you know, it's interesting too, because there is this kind of state political framework and this basin hydrological framework for how they're all connected. And I think, I don't even know if I would break it up as much state by state. I think it's more sort of like user group by user group. And I think, you know, agriculture, for instance, has a lot of the senior water rights in the Colorado River, and they have, I know in Wyoming, I think ag uses 90% of the water or something like that. But as those communities change, and as, you know, maybe the economy isn't as based on cattle ranching or whatever it might be anymore, there's not, the way the water was split up historically doesn't necessarily reflect how we currently use water. And I think that is a hard paradigm to shift, to kind of show how, if we, how do we kind of value, for instance, water, you know, we're at the outdoor retailer trade show right now, how do you value water for recreation when that isn't baked into the legal framework?
Well, that was my next question. We're here with all of these outdoor recreation advocates and an industry that is largely, especially at the summer show here, built around water recreation. What role is there for industry to play in helping folks understand both the challenges and the opportunities around water compacts, which is a pretty darn dry issue if all you want to do is get out there, hop in your kayak, and go for a float?
Yeah, I think it's, I think the dot connection is sort of the tricky, especially when it is sort of this wonky, how don't we talk about water rights? I think it is sort of making that connection between the water that you comes out of your tap is also the same water that's running through Clear Creek or whatever it might be, that's also the water that is assigned, you know, legally allocated. And I think it is, I think in terms of outdoor industry responsibilities, I think there is sort of a value, like a lobbying value, in a way of getting, you know, people in this building who all use water but might not necessarily be communicating it at that on the same page, and trying to keep, you know, find a way to kind of preserve and conserve water.
I want to talk about the adventure part of this as well, because obviously this is an incredibly exciting thing to spend as long as you did, going as far as you did down the river. What were some of the most exciting moments for you on the green?
Ooh, exciting. The kind of first big, really exciting part was right below Flaming Gorge Dam. There's kind of a chunk of, there's a chunk right below the dam that gets paddled, commercially fished quite a bit. And then there's one really big rapid right below that. And that was kind of the first real rapids I had run by myself. I did, you know, most of the trip by myself, but there's a lot of flat water on that river. And so that was kind of the first, I was in a pack raft. It was sort of a new boat to me. And that was the first sort of, okay, I need to make the decision about, is this rapid safe to run? I need to think about my line. There's nobody here with me to be like, is this a good idea? Is this not a good idea? So it kind of came down to those, like, did I make a really stupid choice, or is this going to be okay?
I suppose the consequences of making a stupid choice, beyond just the you could die and there's no one behind you with a rescue pack, is all your gear then as well is at risk if you make a bad decision.
If you swim.
At any point, did it get a little too hairy and you're like, this may have been a bad choice?
Not... more in my head than it did in physically. There were definitely, I scouted way more than I would have with other people.
Sure.
You know, I think I was being on the, I think I'm a pretty cautious to overly cautious person. So I was like pretty careful on that kind of thing. But part of why, I mean, there was a lot of reasons why I wanted to look at the green, but one of the big ones was that I was pretty sure I could paddle the whole thing. Like the scope of what I knew, especially the kind of more commonly paddled places were. So yeah, nothing too, I mean, I'm still here.
Yeah, you made it, obviously.
Yeah, I lived.
Give us a view of some of the people you met along the way, either on the river or off the river, as you were talking to people who make their lives along the green.
Yeah, that was really kind of the best. And people were very, very generous with their time and with kind of their insights. But that was the coolest part of the trip, was kind of getting, you know, a nice thing about being a journalist is that it kind of gives you carte blanche to just show up and ask people questions. But, you know, right off the bat, I started in Green River Lakes, which is up in the Wind River Range, and you're on Forest Service land for a little bit, and then you kind of drop right into a lot of historic cattle ranches. And right off the bat, these people who, you know, were coming from a really different perspective than I were super generous with taking me out on their ranches, asking me all these stupid questions, or I'm sorry, the other way around, me asking them really stupid questions and being patient with me. And just sort of like giving me insight about, you know, there's this one guy, Albert Summers, who's a rancher, a sort of cattle rancher, and a statehouse rep in Wyoming, and his family has been ranching there since the 1860s. And so getting that kind of history and stories of what his life looks like, and he he and his sister on the ranch, neither of them have kids. They're trying to decide what's going to happen with the next generation, or like what happens when they can't run the ranch anymore. So it's kind of this really interesting glimpse into people's lives that you don't get otherwise.
For folks like that who make their living along and on the river or depend on the river for water, how much is the threat of climate change top of mind for them? Is this something they're aware of on a day in and day out basis, or is it something that's kind of amorphous? Oh, it might be a problem in 20 years.
No, I think they're much more than I thought. Those people, especially people who are out on the land working every day, whose livelihood is really dependent on how much water they're getting, have a very clear sense of how, you know, how things are shifting, especially somewhere where, like I said, your family's been ranching for 150 years. You have a pretty clear timeline of what that looks like. And it's up there. The glaciers in the Wind River Range feed a lot of the water there, and they have a pretty good sense of, like, those glaciers are changing. And I know that that's my water storage, and I know that that water storage then impacts my ranch. So, yeah, nobody I met, I don't think, not that I can think of, was in denial about climate change at all or cagey about it. Everyone, for the most part, you know, is clear-eyed and realistic and trying to be smart about the future.
But then in a state like Wyoming that is heavily dependent on coal as an economic driver, how do they balance that? We have to do something about climate change. Our economy is dependent on what is one of the largest contributors to this change in climate.
Yeah, I was not in coal country a ton, okay, so I can't speak to that, but I was. The Pinedale Incline and then the Green River Formation are both pretty heavily drilled oil and gas formations. So there was, and the like Pinedale, Wyoming, Vernal, Utah, where I went through, are both sort of like boom and bust, you know, energy towns. And I think it is this, economics plays into it a lot, where people all of a sudden, their livelihood is tied to that. That feels like the reality. There's a lot of fear in all this stuff, I think. So I think, going back to your question earlier about sort of like the changing economies, I think having, trying to build up robust economies in those places that aren't just dependent on resource extraction plays in a lot. And I think that there are some, Vernal, for instance, is a town where, you know, it's right on the edge of Dinosaur National Monument. Rafting and recreation are potentially good, solid, you know, economic drivers. And it's kind of changing that as a bit of a culture shift to change that.
You've done this major project. You've written a book about it. What's next for you? Where do you go from here?
I'm talking about the book a lot and traveling around for that. And I'm actually starting to work on a second book that's sort of about the recreation economy and about ski towns and sort of like the sustainability of ski towns and the idea of living the dream and why it's not necessarily the dream given, you know, economic changes and climate change and what the future is potentially going to look like. So more brutal reporting on that one.
We'll look forward to that and we'll have you back on the podcast because, boy, if this policy stuff is right up our alley, so is life and changing ski towns. Heather Hansman is the author of Downriver, Into the Future of Water in the West. Heather, thank you so much for stopping by today.
Oh, thank you.
Time for a look back at the last days of an American icon, at least the last official days. It was this week in 1985 when highway officials decertified Route 66.
Ever plan to motor west? Travel my way, take the highway that's the best.
As Nat King Cole and so many others sang, it wound from Chicago to LA, or Santa Monica, technically, covering some 2,200 miles across 8 states and 3 time zones. The highway's path dates all the way back to 1857. It was originally a frontier trail that was blazed not by wagons, but by camels, believe it or not. It was a caravan commanded by a Navy lieutenant named Edward Beale. In the decades that followed, wagon trains, then cattle, and then finally cars followed. It was designated as Route 66 in 1926, first became immortalized in John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, and then, of course, the R&B standard written by Bobby Troup and made famous by Nat King Cole in 1946. Troup got the idea for the song, appropriately enough, on a road trip, when he packed up the Buick and headed west, first along US 40, and then Highway 66 to California. It was Troop's wife, Cynthia, who suggested the rhyme, "Get your kicks on Route 66." In the decades that followed, the song was covered by everyone from the Rolling Stones to even Depeche Mode.
Get your kicks on Route 66.
The highway itself, of course, became a symbol of America. As families moved west during the Dust Bowl and then World War II, towns and businesses thrived along the route. And when the interstate highway system came along after the war, what traffic gave, it took away. Interstate 40 was the primary culprit, with the interstate bypassing towns and cities. By the late 60s, most of Route 66 across New Mexico had been replaced by the interstate. The last stretch of the highway in Arizona was decommissioned in 1984, and in June 1985, the American Association of State Highway and Transportation Officials voted to decertify Route 66 across the whole country. Today, it does, of course, live on as a piece of nostalgia. You can find historic markers all along the original road. Parts of it are on the National Register of Historic Places, and preservation groups have tried to save the old motels and neon signs that were the hallmark of a nation migrating west. The most recent surge of interest came thanks to the movie Cars. Pixar's creative director, John Lasseter, was inspired by a road trip with his family. He even hired a road historian to take the creative team down Route 66 as they did research for the film. So the fictional Radiator Springs in the movie Cars is based on real towns named Peach Springs, Arizona, Baxter Springs, Kansas. Peach Springs, by the way, has a population of about 1,000 people today. That is the story along most of Route 66, where the towns declined quickly after the interstate came along. Radiator Springs, on the other hand, is now a real place inside Disney's California Adventure theme park. It gets nearly 10 million visitors a year, or 27,000 people a day on average. And I guess that's America for you, charging $100 a day to experience a fictional Route 66. 34 years after the real Route 66 was decertified this week in Western history. Well, you've made it to the end of another episode of Go West Young Podcast. Life is a highway for us, of course. We will be heading down I-25 to Santa Fe in mid-July for a live episode. Keep an eye on our Facebook page for details on that as we finalize our plans. Thanks again to Heather Hansman for her stories about floating the Green River. You'll find a link to her book, Downriver, in the show notes. And, of course, we love to get your feedback on how we are doing. Send those emails to podcast@westernpriorities.org. Or if you enjoyed this episode, share it with a friend or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts so other folks can find out what we're up to. I'm Aaron Weiss, and on behalf of all of us at the Center for Western Priorities, have a great 4th of July. We'll be back in a couple weeks.
And when the people are eating the stuff they raise and living in the houses they build, I'll be there too.